all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken. We understand that the 70 weeks a year's prophecy ends with 7 years of tribulation, three of which a false covenant will be made with Israel. We'll protect you. Everybody wants to kill you, but we're for you. And that's the Antichrist telling them that. And in 3.5 years after they built their temple, I believe that's when the temple's going to be built, under that covenant of peace. They'll get their temple all built and proper and everything will be in its place. And Antichrist will say, now's the time, 3.5 years in. And he will break the covenant. He will come into the city and he will sit down on the very Ark of the Covenant saying, I am God. That's huge. And the people of Israel will at that point realize they've been completely deceived. And for 3.5 years, the Antichrist will try to wipe out the Israelites in any way they can. And the Bible says he's going to take the city. And their wives are going to be ravished. And the Bible says, and their residue of the people will run off and be able to get out of the city. But it's going to be just a remnant. And in verse 3 it says, then shall the Lord go forth. So we have a number of things going on here. First of all, he says the city's going to be taken. He says, then he says that the remnant's going to be spared. And then he says, then God goes forth. Isn't that cool? It's at that time. God begins to move in a deliberate way. Now, it's not the first time he's moved. He's been moving all along, right? Rapture. Last days. Rapture. What's happening? You got the witnesses during the first 3.5. They're preaching and they're consuming people by fire and holding back the rain and showing we're God's people. They get killed 3.5 years in and they lie dead in the streets while everybody have a satanic holiday and send gifts to one another. Woohoo! They're dead! Those people who made us feel bad, they're dead! And 3.5 days into their laying there in the streets, the Bible says that they're going to stand up, having been dead for 3 days. They haven't even buried them. Dust themselves off. Hear a voice and slowly ascend in the sight of CNN, Fox News, MSNBC, and everybody else. And now it's on. Then he comes, the Bible says. Verse 2. It says, and it shall come to pass. I'm sorry, wrong chapter. It says, for I will gather the nations. In verse 3. Then shall the Lord go forth and fight against those nations. As when he fought in the day of battle. And God did that many times. You read your Old Testament, you can't help but get excited. Man, the dust comes up off the page and the sweat of the men swinging swords kind of hits you in the face. You know, it's an amazing book, but we don't read it. We let it sit and we say, well, there's nothing in there. It's so hard to read. It's hard to read because you just don't know the end from the beginning. You got to get in there and get your feet wet and get acquainted with some of the characters. You're coming into the story somewhere in the end. You got to go back and find out how we got where we are. The Bible says that he's going to fight as he did when he fought in the day of battle. How did he fight in the day of battle? Well, we got Jericho's walls falling down, don't we? Remember that? The walls fell down. Flat. God won. He took out Pharaoh, the great Egyptian Pharaoh, his entire army, in one fell swoop in the Red Sea. When God fights a battle, it gets fought right, doesn't it? He says he's going to rise up, he's going to see his people, and he's going to fight for them. And the Bible says, and when he comes to fight in verse 4, it says, and his feet shall stand that day in the Mount of Olives. How's he going to do? Well, he split the Red Sea. These guys are in the city, and some of them are in captivity. We saw back in verse 1, actually. And he says, when he steps on the Mount of Olives, this mount butts up to the edge of the city. And when he does it, it's going to move from to the north and to the south, and it's going to give them a thoroughfare to the east. And they're going to run into it. The Bible says he's going to set his foot on that day on the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem, on the east. And the Mount of Olives shall cleave in the midst thereof toward the east and toward the west. Meaning it's moving north and south, but it's going to open up a way through to the west. And it says, and there shall be a very great valley. Now don't think about a valley like you're going to run and fall into. No, the valley is in correspondence to the top of the mountain. It's going to be a valley down to their level, just like the Red Sea opened up. And so this is a valley that's going to be a perfect valley for them to run into. And everybody else is going to do what normal people would do. Run away. But they will have read by now. I'm going to do it. You keep watching. You keep looking to the east because I'm going to break a mountain. I'm going to make a way. I'm going to open the gate. I'm going to let you out just like I opened the Red Sea and let you out. And he says he opens the gate and the Bible says, and ye shall flee into it. In verse 5. To the valley of the mountain. For the valley of the mountain shall reach unto Azal. Yea, ye shall flee like as ye fled before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. And the Lord my God shall come. And what? And all the saints with him. Woohoo, that's us. Guess what? We're in chapter 14 of Zechariah. We get to come back with them. And you know what's going on while they're in this running stage or fleeing? The Bible says the lights go out. It's almost like a time warp, because what happens in the next couple of verses, it says in verse 6, "And it shall come pass in that day that the light shall not be clear nor dark." Verse 7 says, "But it shall be one day which shall be known only to the Lord." Not day, not night, but it shall come to pass that at evening time it shall be light. This is an interesting thing. It's almost like you've got the Twilight Zone music going on in those two verses. Because on the other side, it is as if the entire millennial kingdom has been established as far as the restructuring of the entire world. Because in verse 8 it says, "And it shall be in that day that living water shall go out from Jerusalem." Now, I want you to think in terms of life-giving water, because this is scorched earth time. This whole earth has been inundated with trauma after trauma after trauma. Third of the vegetation, third of the grass, third of the trees. The water has been corrupted by wormwood. I mean, we're talking about a really bad time. So what God has done is He has restructured the entire earth at this time, and He has created an antediluvian situation, a pre-flood world. He has reestablished the Edenic conditions. And part of His doing that is creating not only water, which is life-giving to everybody who's standing there. And the Bible tells us about those people who come out of the Great Tribulation, right? They shall neither what? Thirst anymore. That's part of it. They're thirsty. The sun won't smite them anymore, right? The sun's been hot. They've been getting scorched by the sun. And the Bible says in verse 9, "And the Lord shall be king." I want to go back to verse 8. It shall be in that day that living water shall go out of Jerusalem, half of them toward the former sea, half of them toward the hinder sea, in the summer and in the winter shall it be. There'll be plenty of water. Everybody will be just kind of thrashing it on them and through there and in their faces. "And the Lord shall be king over all the earth. In that day there shall be one Lord, and His name one. And all the land shall be turned as a plain." See, not only is water coming out of Jerusalem, and it's fresh water, by the way, which is a miracle in itself, because that's the Dead Sea down there. It's all salt. It's the lowest place on the face of the earth. But out of Jerusalem, we got water coming out. God's going to do. Why? How? He's going to raise up the plains. In verse 10, it says, "And all the islands, or all the land, shall be turned as a plain. From Geba to Rimmon," it says, "south of Jerusalem, and it shall be lifted up and inhabited in her place." What he's saying is the entire land of Jerusalem, the entire geography is going to be leveled, because there's going to be so many Israelites coming back out of the crevices of the world and saying, you know, where are we going to go? Well, we're going to go home. And we're going to be a people of God. And we're going to rule and reign with our king. And all the earth is going to come to us. And they're going to have enough room, because it's not going to be going over highways and hills. He's going to make it all flat so everybody can fit. Fit comfortably. The Bible says in verse 10 that He's going to make it flat land over there, so they can all be inhabiting it. And the Bible says they all come. In verse 11 it says, "And men shall dwell in it, and there shall be no more utter destruction." Isn't that good? And the Bible says, "But Jerusalem shall be safely inhabited." It's all about Him making it habitable. A habitation for His people. And it happens it seems to coincide right with when He delivers them. He takes them inside this cleft rock. And the Bible says darkness and light. And wait till the evening, and then evening, light. And suddenly you're going to come out. There's going to be water. It's going to be land. Everybody's going to come home. And the Bible says in verse 12, "And this shall be the plague wherewith the Lord will smite those that came against Jerusalem." This is what's going on while they're running into the crevice of the land. This is what God's doing outside. Okay? Not only is He recreating the world, but in verse 12 it says, "Their flesh shall consume away while they stand upon their feet. Their eyes shall consume away in their holes, and their tongues shall consume away in their mouth before they ever hit the ground." Done. Can God do that? If He can speak the worlds into existence by the word of His mouth and hold it by the word of His power, He can talk and speak the word, and in a word. The Bible says He will fight them with the sword of His mouth. One word, and they will dissolve. And they will know they're dissolving. And you want to know what's interesting about that? In pondering that, I thought, that's not the worst of it. Because the moment their soul catapults their body, they're in hell. The terrors that have befallen them here are nothing like the terrors that await them on the other side. The Bible says
that they will fall before they ever hit the ground. And in verse 13, and it shall come to pass in that day that a great tumult will come from the Lord among them, and they shall lay every man hold one of hand of his neighbor, and every man shall rise up against the hand of his neighbor. They're going to start fighting each other. They're going to start swiping at each other with their swords, and they're shooting each other with their guns, and they're going to start hitting each other with clubs and knives. They're going to just start wiping each other out. The Bible says he's going to send a great tumult among them. In verse 14 it says, and Judah also shall fight. There's going to be people out there in the outskirts who are going to fight and have part in the battle. We saw that a little earlier. He says some of them are going to still be out there fighting. And the Bible says, and the wealth of all the heathen round about them, not only are they going to fight, but they're going to spoil the enemy. The Bible says all of the heathen are going to be slaughtered, and they're going to gather their spoil in verse 14. Sounds a lot like Egypt, doesn't it? Go ask all your friends in Egypt to borrow some of their jewelry. And they got it all, and they spoiled the entire nation of Egypt as they went through the Red Sea. They had all their goods, all their stuff. Bible says in verse 15, so shall be the plague of the horse and the mule and the camel and the ass and all the beasts that are in the tents as these plagues. In other words, all the beasts and all of the people that are involved in the camp of the ungodly, the nations and the armies that come against God, they're going to fall by this means. Now finally, in wrapping it up, I'll go over this quickly. It says, it shall come to pass, everybody who's left of all the nations which came against Israel, that's talking about people who are back home. There are people who are converted from other nations. They're all going to come to know the Lord. They're all going to come in and worship the king year by year in verse 16. And if they don't come in verse 17, God's going to withhold rain. But he says specifically in verses 18 and 19 that Egypt has a special place in this whole scenario. Egypt, something about Egypt, right? Because in verses 18 and 19, it says if they don't come, they're going to suffer the plague that happened to everybody else. Now, you could say the plague he's talking about is no rain. But I might be able to superimpose here what happened to Shammai. Do you remember Shammai? He was the guy who came out when David was run out of town. And he was cursing David, and he was throwing rocks at David, and he was spitting toward David's carriage. And Joab got his sword. He said, let me go whack his head off. He says, no. He said, let him curse. If God has ordained him to curse, let him curse. And all of our nations have cursed, especially Egypt and the Arabs, if you will. They've cursed Israel all through the years. But there will be some who get converted somehow in here, and when the nation blooms again, there will be a point when they leave their city of refuge. Don't do what their king tells them to do, what the Lord tells them to do. It very well is possible. He's going to rule with a rod of iron, we know. And he's going to let them be like Shammai. Shammai was safe, but when David went to die, he told Solomon, he said, if that man ever walks out of the city, you get him. You get him. Guess what? He couldn't stand it. He couldn't He left the city one day. Sure enough, woohoo! Got to reckon some vengeance. God says if Egypt doesn't come, they're going to suffer the plague. I think that's probably what's going on there. We'll have to wait and see. Stay tuned. Because we'll be there that day. We'll see it happen. Verse 20 says, in that day, and in verse 21, everything's going to have the theme of the millennium is going to be holiness unto the Lord. And it'll be like a Nike checkmark. You know, Hollister, Abercrombie and Fitch. People are all about the marks. And Cadillac. If you're an older person, it's Cadillac, Pontiac, Buick. You know, I've got my cool truck. This is holiness to the Lord. It's going to be engraved on all the bells of the horses. And the Bible says not only will it be engraved upon the bells of the horses, but it will be upon the pots in the house of the Lord, just like it always was in the bowls. Now the bowls were the bowls that caught the blood of the sacrifice. The pots were places where they would get the ashes and take them outside and throw them away. They were kind of unsung heroes. Nobody really thought about them. But what's going to happen in the millennium is every movement of the tabernacle and the temple worship is going to be meaningful. Even those ashes have meaning. What is he saying about the ashes? What is he saying when he takes them out? And every bit of it, and those Jews will be all lit up and they'll get it. Man, they're going to be on task, on target. No, and they're going to tell the Gentiles, come in. This means this. This means that. And Jesus is seen in this, and he's seen in this, and he's seen in this. And they'll walk up to Jesus and say, what are these wounds in your hand? He says, those are the wounds that made it possible for me to turn unto the little ones. Those are the wounds that made it possible for me to smile on humans who are sinful and unclean. Those are the wounds that made it possible for me to get my people back. Verse 21 says, Yea, every pot in Jerusalem and in Judah shall be holiness unto the Lord of hosts. And all they that sacrifice shall come and take of them and seethe therein. And in that day there shall be no more Canaanite in the house of the Lord of hosts. Canaanites represent the worst of the worst generation. After the flood, 400 years of depravity, and God was going to wipe them out. They gave us Sodom and Gomorrah 400 years earlier. But by the time that Israel had gone into captivity and come back 400 years later, their sin was completely off the charts. They were a wicked, licentious, idolatrous people who were all about immorality, idolatry. And God says, you're going in and you're going to wipe out the Canaanites. And you know what they did? They went in and wiped out most of the Canaanites. And the Canaanites came along and they came back up and they were thorns and pokes in their eyes and in their hearts, right? All through their experience. And subsequently, God says, in that day, there will be no more uncleanness in that land ever again. We're going to have two things going on in the millennium that you want to get your mind around just to kind of ponder sometime. One is the little brush fires everywhere of cities that once were that aren't there anymore. It's going to remind us they were there. That fire is going to be a perpetual flame. And the Bible talks about this river that's flowing from Jerusalem. Because as those burned and this blesses, God is saying, that's the difference between heaven and hell. Hell burns and heaven blesses. Hell just kind of overwhelms and brings us into despair, but heaven brings us into blessing, refreshment, and good, and joy. And he says that's going to be the illustration throughout the millennium. It's a great book. Aren't you glad you came tonight? I think I am. I'm glad you came so I could tell somebody. God bless you.